You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Madison's Latino Chamber of Commerce has a new program to help Spanish speakers start their own businesses. We get the details.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says its budget shortfall could be fixed temporarily by raising fees for hunting and fishing licenses, in addition to new fees for other outdoor activities.
The DNR outlined other alternatives to solving the budget problem, including new efforts to attract more people to hunting and fishing in Wisconsin. These ideas are all part of a report mandated by the state legislature and Governor Scott Walker.
George Meyer joins us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. George, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
Well, what's your reaction about this DNR plan to consider hiking some fees for hunting and fishing licenses along with some other fees?
Well, I'll start by saying this report that the Department of Natural Resources put out is probably the most excellent report I've read about funding for fish and wildlife in the state. Really a great job. Very thorough. They have shown, or in great data showing, that they have about a $5 million shortfall in what's called a fish and wildlife account. Now, that's the account that funds all fish management in the state, wildlife management, and the state's conservation warden program. And they haven't had a fee, any significant fee increase for over 10 years now, probably a dozen years now.
Right, that's a long time. Why haven't fees increased since then?
Well, you know, the legislature and the governor have not been supportive of fee increases, and hopefully that'll change. But DNR obviously had to, costs went up, and they've had the shortfall for many years, and they ended up having to cut over that period of time about 130 positions in the fish management program, wildlife management, law enforcement, research, and other support programs that support those programs. And that has really had an impact on the services that sportsmen and women and other outdoor recreational users have seen over the last dozen years.
So are you in support of raising some of these fees?
Yes, and you know, I represent, as you indicated, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. We have supported additional funding for the Fish and Wildlife account for years. And the surveys, you know, the DNR surveys in this that they have had that are in the report show that there is a support for increasing hunting and fishing fees. You know, sportsmen are willing to pay their own way. It's been a dozen years. Cost on everything, whether it's your pickup truck or your firearm or your fishing rods, everything is going up. Obviously, those costs have gone up for the DNR. And we want to continue having, you know, really a good fishing, hunting in the state. To do that, we know it's going to cost us some more. So some reasonable fees, I think, would be supported by a majority of state hunters and anglers in the state.
We're talking with George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, former Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about the DNR's proposal to raise fees to help solve a budget shortfall. And there are some critics, though, George, who say that raising fees like this could have a chilling effect on the number of people who decide to practice these sports. And we're already seeing a decline, for instance, in the number of people who want to hunt. So isn't raising fees going to make things even less palatable to people who want to start?
No, let me put it in perspective. Don't say putting a $2 or $3 increase or onto a hunting and fishing or a hunting license, as an example, is not going to deter very many hunters. And in fact, there has been a decrease in hunters over the years, but that has very little to do with the cost of the license. It's because of demographics. The baby boom generation, people are starting to get out of hunting, and that was the larger numbers we had 20 years ago were as a result of, you know, that big influx of the baby boom generation. That generation is fading out. And so you're going to see a reduced number of hunters, and that's what we're seeing now. And that has little to do with the license fee increase. It might have some very marginal impacts, but not very much. And candidly, hunters and anglers want to have good wildlife management, fisheries management. But the report also addresses another issue. There's other people that benefit from the wildlife areas, the fishery areas, and the services conservation wardens produce and carry out. So there is a call for looking at, for instance, putting a fee on for people that go on to state wildlife areas or fishery areas for other purposes. And I always give the example. There's no hunting seasons open in the summer. But if you go past many wildlife areas in July, you'll see cars parked there. And they're doing many things, maybe bird watching. They may be running their dogs or just taking a hike through there. And there is good information to support the need for other people that use these services to also contribute. And that'll help make up for the loss of hunters over the years. And by the way, anglers, the number of anglers in the state is not decreasing. And I don't think that trend will be a trend to have reduced anglers in the state.
In Wisconsin, as you were saying, it's a prime destination for outdoor sports recreation, and it brings in big tourist dollars, too. Do you think there's a danger that Wisconsin could lose its footing there if it doesn't get a better foundation on the financial aspect of natural resources management?
That is really an excellent point, Veronica. You know, this state, whether it's for a hunting game or fisheries, we draw in tremendous people in the state for hunting and fishing. And even set aside sort of the game aspect of it, Wisconsin is second in the nation in the number of people that come in the state for bird watching. 400,000 people a year, second only to Florida.
Wow.
And that's why you need good management of our lands and habitat, whether it's your forest or uplands or your lakes, to have bring in those tourist dollars.
Now, looking at the decline of people who are going out hunting, do you think that chronic wasting disease has anything to do with that and the way that the state has chosen to manage that?
It truly did the first few years when it was discovered in southwestern Wisconsin. And there were probably some number, it may have been, a significant number of people that quit hunting as a result of that. That's not continuing. We may have lost those people permanently, but it's not showing to be a continuing increase of impact on the number of hunters in the state from the data I've seen. And the key there is if people do have concerns about if they hunt in an area where there's chronic wasting disease, the state makes available at low or no cost or low cost testing that can be done on the animals, and that's what I've done over the years since I hunt in areas that are close to or now within the chronic wasting disease zone.
And, George, as we start to wrap up here, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said lawmakers are open to the idea of splitting the DNR into, I think it is, two separate agencies. And this is an idea that has been discussed on and off for a few years now. What do you make of this idea?
Well, actually, the proposal on the table was worse than two agencies. The proposal that Representative Jarko has brought forward to the governor and the legislature splits it into five agencies. And I can tell you, and I think every other person that's ever had a major responsibility of leading the Department of Natural Resources will tell you, these issues go together. Forestry and wildlife, there's wildlife that has to be managed in forest lands. The forestry people do the timber management on wildlife lands. Water quality is critical to fisheries, and so it's important to have the fish managers have direct within the agency contact with water quality people. And the water quality people depend on fish management for observations that they need to do their job. The interrelationship of all these programs is numerous. There's probably about 50 or 60 examples I could give you. And it's an integrated natural resources agency, which makes it more effective and cost efficient than splitting into five agencies, or difficulty of coordination, increased cost because you're going to have more people. There's going to be increased cost over time as people in other agencies get classification increases. As an example, the Division of Tourism would grow about ninefold. So you're going to have everybody that's involved in management over there get a significant pay increase. So it is a terrible idea for natural resources management in the state.
George, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Veronica.
That was George Meyer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and former Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. He was with us there to talk about the DNR's proposal to raise fees to help solve a budget shortfall. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a new program will provide bilingual support and resources to people hoping to open their own businesses.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
One of the most fabled stars in human history, the Star of Bethlehem, is also one of the biggest mysteries. What exactly was the Star of Bethlehem? Meg Jones tells us the story of a Wisconsin man who found one possible answer in his coin collection.
Of all the stars known to humans, one fabled star in particular has grabbed the curiosity and imagination of so many, the Star of Bethlehem. According to the Gospel of Matthew, it's the star that led the wise men to the baby Jesus, an event known as Epiphany, which is celebrated this week in many churches. For astronomers and stargazers, the question has always been, what exactly was the Star of Bethlehem? Michael Molnar, an astronomer who earned his doctorate at the UW-Madison, came up with an interesting theory in the late 1990s. He believes the star that attracted the wise men bearing frankincense, gold, and myrrh was likely the planet Jupiter appearing in the constellation of Aries the Ram. Molnar's quest to unmask the Star of Bethlehem started, oddly enough, when he bought an ancient coin. The coin was minted in Syria soon after the Romans annexed Judea and featured a picture of Zeus on one side and Ares on the other with a star above the ram. Molnar knew that astronomer Claudius Ptolemy had noted that Ares was the symbol of Judea. The Magi told King Herod that they saw a star rising in the east, a morning star. As Jupiter orbits around the sun, it eventually disappears from view on Earth before reemerging in the eastern sky. Molnar began to consider that Jupiter might have been the Star of Bethlehem. Jesus' actual birth date is not known. Biblical historians most often estimate it was sometime between 6 BC and 4 BC. Molnar checked the dates of when Jupiter was in the east and the constellation of Aries was close and referenced them against the years when scholars believe Jesus was born. Only one date popped up, April 17th, 6 BC. Whether Jupiter eclipsed by the moon is actually the star heralding the birth of Jesus is certainly open to debate, but it's a fascinating theory, and one that might never have come to light. That's because Molnar is lucky to be alive. When he was a PhD student at UW-Madison, he was working in his sixth-floor office on the evening of August 23, 1970. Late that night, he tried to buy candy from a vending machine, but it jammed and took his money. Still hungry, he decided to go home much earlier than normal. Not long after, a van stolen by anti-war protesters exploded outside Sterling Hall, killing a researcher. Molnar's office went up in flames and he lost much of his research. Part of his burned dissertation was found blown out of the building days later. Molnar went on to perform pioneering research in magnetic stars and to build his coin collection, never realizing the scientific clues his hobby might hold.
Meg Jones is a journalist and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, a new initiative in Madison hopes to provide support for Latino entrepreneurs to help them make their business dreams a reality.
Maya Medrano is here to tell us about the Emerging Business Development Center. She's the president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County, which is launching the project. Myra, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to help spread some of the great initiatives that we're doing at the Latino Chamber of Commerce.
So why is opening this type of center a priority for the chamber?
Well, the Latino Chamber of Commerce, its mission is to advocate for Latino entrepreneurship. And we currently have our home office, which will remain our home office at Centro Hispano on Badger Road. And that's where we had a lot of the technical assistance appointments with people who were interested in opening up a business. But what we really wanted is to have an actual physical space where the people coming in seeking for help could actually stay a while, mm-hmm. and use some of the resources that we have at the Latino Chamber of Commerce, perhaps set up a meeting with another member of the chamber that can help them with their business plan. So being in the right physical space is very important as Latino entrepreneurs consider themselves entrepreneurs and consider really looking to see what they need in order to make that a success.
So you mentioned technical assistance. What kind of services and support will you be able to offer?
Well, one of the things that we want to do is, should you have an LLC or should you have a sole proprietorship? So sometimes it can be just as simple as answering that question, but sometimes it gets more complicated. It's actually drafting a business plan, a marketing plan. Perhaps you need help with asking for capital. So we really want to be able to provide resources that are culturally relevant in addition to dual language. So we know that we want to be able to provide the information in Spanish, but also help them to give their presentations in English.
Mm. And how many startups do you hope to be able to support initially through the center?
Well, we're starting with four. We're hoping to get to 10 within the next 2 years. And it really will be a center dedicated to really one-on-one service. So we really want to start with a handful of entrepreneurs and slowly grow it so that we have our capacity as well to help them be successful. So we really want to ensure that we're doing everything right from the start.
So will they just be coming there or will they actually have space there? Is it like an incubator where they'll be working kind of side by side?
Yeah, but so the first, the people who actually will be at the Business Development Center will be in the incubator type of environment. So they will be there. They'll have their own desk, they'll have their own, internet access, be able to use some of that space to have perhaps a meeting. So there will be actual office space reserved for them. But we want our members to use the Emerging Business Development Center for them as well. Again, if they have an appointment and they need to perhaps talk to another member regarding questions on accounting or maybe they need to talk to a business lawyer, they can most certainly use that space as well.
Maya Medrano is president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County, talking about a new project that is a bilingual center for entrepreneurs and for Latino-owned businesses to help them get off the ground. So, Myra, the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County has been around since 2003. Mm-hmm. What trends have you seen in the types and number of Latino-owned businesses in our area?
Well, one of the things that our organization has seen is an increase. You can't rely on the trends to dictate whether it'd be a good time to open a business or not. But we've seen that Latinos have that entrepreneurial spirit, and we see that they are really willing to sustain for their families and really have a lot to contribute to a local economy. So we've just seen an increase. Despite seeing how the economy is, Latinos are opening a lot more businesses.
And it sounds like part of the program will be mentorship
Correct.
Program. So how will you match up the mentors with the entrepreneurs?
Well, we have a really good organic system right now. We have a lot of members that are part of the Latino Chamber who become members for the sole purpose of mentorship to say, hey, you know, I'm an expert in building a website, and I've had a lot of experience with developing marketing plans. Who can I help? Please connect me to the right people. And that has really evolved over the years. So we really have a great business resource community in our area, and we are just the connector. We're just the communicator between organizations, between people who want to be able to provide that expertise, and then to the people that actually need mm-hmm. them.
So as you mentioned earlier, financing is a huge challenge for any new business. Mm-hmm. Will the Emerging Business Development Center be able to help connect these startups with potential funding so they can launch?
Yeah, most definitely. Access to capital is up there. When we do an assessment on the business needs of these individuals that come in, that's one of the things that they say that's really difficult is access to capital. So we want to be able to provide them the information and the knowledge for them to have to eliminate some of those barriers, some of those challenges, some of those nuances that come to applying for lending. So being able to connect them with local financial institutions, being able to connect them to the Small Business Administration, WBIC and Wisconsin Women's Business Initiative Corporation, it's a great way to be able to say, hey, I know someone at this organization that you can talk to. Mm-hmm. That in itself speaks volumes.
And you said that you have 4 right now. You're hoping to grow to 10. Mm-hmm. You know, there are probably a lot of great ideas out there. A lot of people have ideas for businesses. Some are probably more viable than others. How will people apply and be accepted for the program?
Well, what we want people to come in and let's chat. Let's have an informal conversation about what you need and some of the expectations that you want from the Business Development Center. Ideally, we want people to submit an executive summary, and for people who don't have an executive summary, for us to help them with that. So it really is getting the right people to the right entrepreneurs, and that's one way of helping them is just asking a simple question. Yeah.
And as we wrap up, I think you have an open house coming up.
Yes.
Can you give people details in case they'd like to come?
Yeah, we're located at the Chase Bank Building in Monona at 802 West Broadway, suite number 102. We will be having a celebration, an open house on January 26th from 5 to 7 p.m.
Great. Well, Myra, thanks so much for coming to talk with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Myra Medrano is president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Dane County, which is launching the Emerging Business Development Center to provide bilingual support and resources to Latino-owned startups in the Madison area.
Coming up, we'll find out what goes into the decision about whether or not to change your name when you get married. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Snap Judgment. This week, the team is letting their curiosity get the better of them with a show called Contents Unknown. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, in Japan, a law that's over 100 years old dictates that all married couples choose one surname. 96% of the time, couples choose the husband's last name, although women today are challenging that law in court, according to a recent report in the New York Times. In China, women always keep their surname when they get married, but that's because the culture privileges a father's lineage even after marriage.
Choices don't necessarily make things easier. In the United States, many women choose between keeping their last name, hyphenating names with their new partner, or picking a new name altogether. It's a decision that has a long-reaching impact on maybe future children and also personal identity.
We want to know, how did you and your partner decide what to do about last names? If you're a woman married to a man, did you take your husband's last name? If you're part of a same-sex couple, how did you decide? And are you happy with the decision you made? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Scheibley is with us now. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University. She studied marital naming for 25 years. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, what do most women choose for their last name when they get married in the United States?
Most women choose to take their husband's last name. About 92% of women change their last name to that of their spouse when they marry.
Has that changed much in the last, say, decade or so?
Not in the last decade. In the last generation, it's changed a bit, moving up from about 4 or 5% to about the 7 or 8% it is now. But hardly a huge movement.
Does that surprise you at all as someone who's been studying this for over two decades?
Yeah, when I started this, I thought, oh, surely by 25 years from now, that will be in the 40% of women maintaining their birth surname when they marry. So, yeah, I'm shocked. But I now, based on what I know, I don't expect that, you know, we're ever going to get much above 15% of women keeping their birth surname.
What kinds of things? Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Because tradition is extremely strong. Right, marital traditions of women taking their husband's last name really operate strongly in our culture. It's how women demonstrate love for their husbands, right? It's how we identify family, right? Everybody has the same last name. Now, obviously, that makes no sense because people get divorced. We have all these reconstituted families. But nonetheless, that's how it works in the U.S.
What kinds of things do women take into account when they're trying to make this decision, do you think?
Well, women who keep their birth surname tend to focus more on things like being a feminist or their identity, right? I identify with my birth surname and I'm going to keep it. But women who are changed their last name tend to really be more interested in the tradition. This is traditionally what we do when we marry. So it just depends. Some women, of course, who decide to keep their birth surname do it for a really practical reason, and that's, they say, bureaucracy. You know, I have to push all those papers, too much work, and so I just decided to keep my own name.
You know, there was some backlash not that long ago when Amal Alamuddin became Amal Clooney.
Yeah.
She was an accomplished human rights lawyer, and she took George Clooney's last name. I mean, I guess he's George Clooney, so that would be tempting. But is this still, you know, a loaded issue today?
Oh, I think it is, and I just cannot see it changing. So you sit down and you particularly talk to men and young men who are of marriage age, and you say, well, what do you expect? And they do expect that their spouse or wife will take their last name, right? And they think that women are more committed to the marriage when they do so. So I can't imagine that these kinds of social norms will change. And even things about, like, identification, I don't know if you did it or your listeners did it, but even my child, who's 25, when she was in middle school, she would write her first name with the boy of the week's last name.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have done that. I mean, it's
so
interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
We don't socialize men, boys, into doing that, right? Boys are not trying out their first name with some girl's last name.
We're talking right now with Lori Shively. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University. She's been studying this, marital naming, for 25 years. Let's go ahead and take a call now. We've got Kayla joining us from De Pere. Kayla, hi.
Hi.
What did you decide to do?
I did not change my last name when I got married.
Okay. Well, how come? What's your thinking?
What you said about the paperwork, that was one of the reasons. Honestly, I was a little lazy and didn't want to go through all that. But I also, I've been, you know, Kayla Sell for 27 years now, and I kind of didn't want to change that. It's who I am. And the feminism point as well. It's just, I don't have to change my last name because I got married.
All right, Kayla, thank you for sharing that. And Kayla, I think, echoes, you know, a lot of women, me included, I guess I'll say, and I thought I've been Veronica Rickert for as long as I can remember. It just felt foreign, the idea of suddenly being Veronica somebody else, even though he has an easier to pronounce last name than I do. So, again, it was tempting. But does Kayla kind of encapsulate some of what the thinking is for women who do keep their name, Lori?
Yeah, she does, indeed. One thing that would be interesting to know is that women who are well-educated are more likely to keep their birth surname when they marry. So that may, in fact, have been a factor for Kayla, too, when she made her marital name decision.
Kayla, thanks a lot for that call, and we're going to go next to Shayna in Madison. Hi, Shayna.
Hi.
What did you decide?
So I chose my maiden name as my middle name and then took my husband's last name as my last name.
Ah, yeah, that's another choice. So how do you feel about that one?
Me?
Yeah, are you happy with that decision?
Yeah, I like it. And when you first change your name over and you have to write your new name, it's very hard to remember. So writing my maiden name first helped me transition into the change of writing my new identity. And I like it because we don't have any boys in our family, so the name ended with my sister and I. So that's a little piece of keeping my family history.
All right, Shana, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And a couple of examples there, Loria. Anything strike you about how Shana decided what to do?
Yeah, that particular thing that she did is becoming more common. You know, somewhere about 20% of women will keep their birth surname as their middle name and then take their husband's last name. So that is not uncommon. That is becoming slightly more common because that way women can, as she said, hold on to their identities but also have that connection to their spouse.
You know, looking at the traditions around marital naming, I mean, historically, women were considered at one point to be the property of their husband. And I think it, as far back as what, the 50s or 60s, if you did get married, sometimes you were just the Mrs. and then you would be, you know, Mrs. George Clooney or whoever you are. I mean, is that something that women think about, that sort of property aspect of it?
I don't think women really think about the property aspect of it. I think women are more likely just to think about keeping their birth surname or using it as a middle name, but not about, oh, if I do this, I'm my spouse's property. I don't think that overt kind of stigma is associated with it. That is, it obviously in the United States has a positive connotation. It's not, oh, my God, I've agreed to be property of my spouse.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Kay this time in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. When I got married, I hyphenated my name with my birth name first and then a hyphen and then his name. And I did that because I really liked my own first last name, and I'm very Irish, and it was the Irish name. When I got divorced, I just dropped his name. And if I had to do it again or if I remarried at this point, I would skip the hyphen because the hyphen was kind of a pain.
So you'd skip the hyphen and just keep your maiden name?
Well, I would keep my maiden name and his name, but no hyphen.
No hyphen. Okay, I got it. Kay, thank you for sharing that. And the hyphenated name, we haven't really talked so much about that yet, Lori. How popular is that?
Very unpopular. About 1% of women hyphenate, because hyphenating is really hard because people just automatically lop off one of the names, and our whole system is not set up for people with hyphenated names, right? You don't fit into the little dots when you fill out forms, right? It's a really hard naming option, I think.
Are there other countries that have naming conventions that are more simple or more straightforward?
Well, except for the people who don't change their names at all, some people do in Latin American countries, do the woman's last name of the husband's last name, but in practicality in everyday life, they don't use their husband's last name. I mean, the whole thing about naming is really becomes about tracing ancestors, right? So that becomes people's concern. If women just keep their name, would that confuse how we traced ancestors in that their children may have different surnames than they do? But my response to that is, heck, women are really lost under today's system, right? Because they're the ones who change their name and become separated from their birth families. So, and we've managed to keep track of women. So any kind of change, we would still manage to keep track of people over generations.
Lori Shively is with us now. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University. And the New York Times recently asked women to respond with their stories about whether or not they changed their names when they got married and how they made that decision. And we're picking up on that question now here on Central Time.
And we'd love to hear from you. Did you change your name when you got married? How did you make your decision to change it, to not change it, or something in between? Did you worry about being a bad feminist like some women do if you changed your name to that of your husband? Are you happy with whatever choice you made? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about where we stand on the issue of whether or not to change your name when you get married. Mostly this is a choice facing women, but some men do change their names as well. Lori Scheible is with us now. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University.
And we'd love to hear from you. Did you change your name when you got married? How did you make that decision? Did you feel pressure to change your name, or were you glad to leave it behind? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Michelle with us first from Janesville. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I was just calling in to say that when I married my first husband, I kept my maiden name and took his last name with no hyphen because I had identified with that birth name for so long that I just wanted to keep it as part of who I was.
And how did that feel to you? Did that feel like a good decision?
It felt like a great decision. My father-in-law was not too happy about it, but I didn't really care, so I just did what I wanted to do. It helped me still be me, but yet be married and obviously committed to the marriage.
Do you find that both the people know you as Michelle, both last names, or do they just generally lean toward one?
No, they identify with both.
All right, Michelle, thank you for the call and sharing your experience there. Another vote, we heard from a woman earlier as well. Michelle also opted to keep her maiden name and take her husband's name, no hyphen. What do you say to her story, Lori?
Well, I think that certainly it's a good solution for some people. It's just, it's handling it bureaucratically, right? Because when you go to the doctor's office, how do they handle that? You know, is your name all run together? Do you have a space? But my whole thing about naming in general is women and men need to do what makes them happy, right? That you need to make the decision that's the most comfortable for you. And that is, you can't waste a whole lot of guilt thinking, I'm a bad feminist, you know? You just have to do what you think will work for you at that time. That said, men need to also be willing to listen to women who want to keep their birth name and be amenable. So, and I always tell my male students, hey, take the high road, because you know that the odds are that this woman's going to change her last name to that of yours. So be decent. Mm. So that's my interpretation of that.
Have you come across many men who decide to take their wife's last name?
It is exceedingly rare. You would never come across it in a sample survey. And oftentimes when people tell me, oh, I know somebody who did that, I keep thinking, everybody must know the same 100 people in the United States, because it is exceedingly rare.
All right, Michelle, thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Carrie in Mosinee. Carrie, hi.
Hi. Well, I would be one of those 100 people that you were just mentioning. My husband assumed my name, and I assumed his name. When we got married, he changed his middle name to my maiden name, and my last name then became my maiden name and his last name. And then we carried it on further with our children and used my maiden name as their middle name. So we kept both names in our lineage.
So he has your last name as his middle name. Is that right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Lori, what about that option?
I think that option is again, relatively rare, but certainly not as rare as a man just totally switching to the woman's last name because he's still carrying his last name. So I do think, indeed, that is somewhat more common, but again, you know, really rare, because many men are not open to that, changing any part of their name. So that's why it's so rare. But that's awesome that your husband did that.
Well, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate hearing your story there. And we're going to go next to Jennifer joining us from Eau Claire. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I chose to keep my last name. And I thought it was a very good decision for me in the end, but it did take a lot of consideration and time to figure out what would be best for me and my partner. But in the end, I did keep mine, and I kind of did it for a multitude of reasons, including kind of the feminist view that I'm not property and that I wanted us to be seen as equals. and going into our marriage, and then also just because I am the last in my bloodline, so I'm trying to take pride in being the last Bialik. So there was kind of multiple reasons, and we also, like, the person who was just on agreed that our children's middle name would be my maiden name and my current last name, and then take his as their last name.
And do your children also have separate middle names from your maiden name?
No, and we don't have any children yet. We're recently married.
Oh, and you're going to do it. Okay, I'm asking for personal reasons, actually. My children have hyphenated last names, and it seems so unfair to them that they have these complicated, laborious last names, and I just have one last name. So interesting options there, Jennifer. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. And Lori, what do you say to that?
I think that most women, the research shows that for women who kept their birth surname when they married, about 95% of those people gave their children their husband's last name and the wife's last name as a middle name. Exactly what your caller explained. So hyphenating like you did for your kids is really rare.
Really? Yeah, and I think
but
there's a reason for that.
Kids are resilient, right? They'll be fine. They can work their way through it. It'll seem normal. It's normal for them.
Yeah, a friend pointed out that it was kind of like passing the buck. We couldn't decide. It was when we just decided to give them both names. And now they have both, and they'll have to decide later on when they get married. So, yeah,
it's not such a bad decision. It's okay.
It's working out so far. We're talking with Lori Scheible right now, senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University, talking about marital naming and how couples decide whose last name to take, and generally, overwhelmingly, a woman takes her husband's last name. And we're finding out what you did, how you made your decision at 800-642-1234. And let's go next to Rebecca in Appleton. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. So I am in a very interesting situation where I was previously married, and in that marriage, I took my husband's last name. And I've since been divorced, but I retain that name because in that time, in the 10 years or so that I've had that last name, I graduated from college and I received some work certifications and I grew my career. And the people in my field, I'm lucky enough that they really know me by that name. So this summer, I am getting remarried and I am struggling to decide whether I should keep this name that I have taken for myself, which is really my ex-husband's last name, or if I will be taking my new husband's name. For simplicity reasons and because I'm known in my field by my last name, I'd like to keep it, but my new husband is having some issues with that because it is another man's name.
I was just going to ask you what he thought of it. I mean, in some cases, you could say, well, this is my decision, it's my name, but there's a new partner to consider. So that's a complicated one. Lori, any thoughts for our
call? No, I exactly could see that problem and see that issue because I've heard other women say that. Here's my suggestion, which feel free to ignore. Maybe it'd be a good time to return to your birth surname because at least that would be neutral. But I do understand you have degrees in your marital name, and it's hard, right? And you've used that name for 10 years of your adult life. So it is an extremely difficult thing to decide.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for calling, and good luck with that decision. We had a tweet from Megan S. who said, my fiancé does not want me to give up my name. He would rather take mine than have me lose it. I personally am undecided. That seems like a sort of unusual based on what you said, Lori.
Yeah, that's a nice reversal. So it's a lot of responsibility, right, for this woman to decide that, oh my goodness, if we all have my last name, what does that mean? But, you know, she obviously has to be comfortable with it. But, you know, if she wants everybody to have the same last name, certainly seems like a nice compromise on his part.
And, Lori, as we get ready to wrap up here, do people ever mash their two names together and do a portmanteau? Does that happen?
Oh, yes, people do that. But people who do that tend to have simpler names, right? Or some people just pick out letters of their name and their spouse's, future spouse's last name and kind of make a new name out of this combination of letters, you know? So, but again, all those things are rare.
Yeah.
Really rare.
I thought of that. I would have been Gardert, though, which is not a pretty name. So, yeah, interesting options, but still one overwhelmingly winning women taking the husband's last name. Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
That was Lori Scheible, senior lecturer in sociology at Pennsylvania State University, and she was with us to talk about the conventions and trends surrounding marital naming. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.